Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. In Washington, D.C., I'm Ron Elving.
And in St. Louis, Missouri, I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, you are in Missouri visiting one of our member stations and meeting the listener.
Absolutely. KWMU, brought to you from the fine folks at St. Louis Public Radio, having a wonderful time. I should also tell you this week there was an event at Barbara Eagleton's house, and if you ever want to talk about politics of trivia and in the past and great history,
Thomas Eagleton, 1972.
And, you know, there's just such amazing memorabilia all over her house. Barbara Eagleton is a wonderful friend of public radio, and she's just an absolute wonderful person.
Well, hats off to her, and thanks to her for entertaining you, and I know just how difficult that can be. So let me just say it's a pleasure to have you with us, even in absentia.
And what a primary week it's been.
Have you heard out there in Missouri, Ken? I understand that Christine O'Donnell, whom we pretty much agreed could not possibly beat Mike Castle in a primary, beat Mike Castle in a primary.
Well, I kind of think that nothing is impossible anymore. And for all we know, I mean, she could win in November. Do I think she will? No. Do I think the Democrats will keep that seat long held by Joe Biden? I do. Do I think that this seriously hurts the Republicans' chances of taking control of the Senate? I do. My numbers had them winning 7 seats, including Delaware. I don't see that happening anymore. But who knows? I mean, we've been wrong about so many things, and I think it's kind of good that we're wrong because I like being surprised, but boy, of all the surprises, this was the biggest one.
You know, I think you have to look at the logical elements of any election. You have to look at what's happened in the past and look at the 250,000 people who voted for Mike Castle last time he ran for re-election and say, hey,
In the general election,
wouldn't we figure that at least, say, 15 or 20% of those people would turn out to vote for him in a primary on the Republican side? Now, of course, a lot of those 250,000 who voted for him in 2008 were not Republicans. They were independents. They were Democrats. And they were not eligible to participate in this primary. But I don't know how many people would have possibly foreseen that only 27,000 votes would come out for Mike Castle, a guy with a 40-year career, first elected to the state legislature in 1966. Very few enemies, very few detractors in Delaware. But where he had people who didn't believe in him was down in Kent and Sussex counties, the lower two counties of Delaware. And they turned out in big numbers, relatively speaking, for Christine O'Donnell, who won with 30,500 votes.
And what's so remarkable about this is that the message the Republican establishment got in the Alaska primary when Lisa Murkowski was caught napping by Joe Miller, well, they said this cannot happen in Delaware. We're ready for this Tea Party surge, this Sarah Palin surge, this Christine O'Donnell surge. And they went all out to defeat Christine O'Donnell. Perhaps they went too far. I mean, the chairman of the party called her, like, absolutely insane.
A fraud.
Or basically all but anything.
Said she
but,
couldn't
you know,
be elected dog catcher.
Dog catcher, right? But it was just remarkable to watch that. And look, it's one thing for the Tea Party to win in Alaska. Replacing Lisa Murkowski with Joe Miller doesn't hurt their chances. And in Utah, you know, when the Tea Party candidate Mike Lee is now the Republican nominee instead of the incumbent Bob Bennett, well, I mean, ultimately, that's not going to hurt the Republican Party as far as holding the seat in November because it's a very conservative state. But Delaware is a blue state. Joe Biden has won the seat over and over again. The last Republican, I guess, was Bill Roth, who won in 1994.
For the Senate.
It just seems like, you know, of a seat that they could pick up. They could very well pick up Illinois. They will definitely pick up Indiana and North Dakota. But Delaware was one of those blue states that they really had an opportunity to win. But again, nobody would have said that Scott Brown, a Republican, was going to win Ted Kennedy's seat. Of course, Martha Coakley did not run a good campaign at all, and I'm sure Chris Coons, the Democrat in Delaware, was a far superior candidate.
Well, let me stop you just for one second there. Everyone is assuming Chris Coons is a much better candidate than Martha Coakley. We haven't really heard much from Chris Coons. He hasn't had much scrutiny. He is the Newcastle County Executive. That is the most populous county in Delaware. It's the one that has both Wilmington and Newark in it. And that's where you assume the votes are going to be, and you assume he's going to be fine. And everybody from Karl Rove on over is assuming that Chris Coons wins this seat. But we don't really know much about him. What if he turns out to be a Martha Coakley? What if he has a glass jaw?
And what if there's a decline in enthusiasm for the Democratic Party, which we see everywhere in the country? We could see it in Delaware as well. And what if this Christine O'Donnell excites the crowd to get out and vote? I don't think it happens, but stranger things have happened this year.
And indeed, she has already done something which all the cool heads agreed could not possibly be done. And she is personable and she is presentable. And I don't know why people didn't pay attention to all the information they had been given about her background and about her lack of any kind of preparation for any office or perennial candidacy, living off the donations to her campaigns and so forth. That didn't seem to wash with the Republican voters of Kent and Sussex counties that came out for her. But who knows? Sometimes just the personal appeal of somebody can plow right over all the information about them.
She did seem very Sarah Palin-esque primary night. She did the "You Betcha."
You betcha! There's another woman I gotta thank. You betcha! Thank you, Governor Palin, for your endorsement.
You know, we keep rolling our eyes about these Sarah Palin endorsements. Half of them are on Facebook, half of them are on Twitter. I think she actually endorsed Christine O'Donnell by calling into the Hannity show on Fox. But I don't know what to make of the Palin effect, because she also endorsed the moderate in New Hampshire, Kelly Ayotte. And I'm not saying that's why Kelly Ayotte won, but Ayotte narrowly beat a very conservative candidate, Ovid LaMontagne, in the primary, but just by a handful of votes.
Well, don't you think that it must have helped at least a little bit for her to endorse Ayotte when the Tea Party in New Hampshire preferred LaMontagne?
I'm just wondering what Sarah Palin's goal is. It's certainly not to endorse the most conservative candidate, because that was not the case in New Hampshire or Iowa when she endorsed Terry Branstad.
Or Arizona with John McCain.
Right. But at the same time, she also endorsed Brian Murphy in Maryland, who got no votes. I got like 27% or something like that against Bob Ehrlich in the governor's race. I just don't know what the game is. But to say that it's insignificant misses the story completely.
You know, between Sarah Palin and a sort of comrade in arms of convenience, Jim DeMint, the South Carolina Republican senator, these are two people who, unbidden by the National Party, serving no agenda other than their own and their principles, have gone out into a number of states, gotten behind candidacies that the National Republican Senatorial Committee was trying to discourage or suppress, and helped these people get elected over the preferences of their own Senate Republican leadership, over the preferences of their national party, and over the preferences of the establishment within those individual states. Between Sarah Palin and Jim DeMint, they seem to have at least aligned with half a dozen winners in these primaries who defeated more established candidates or more establishment candidates. And most of those people, O'Donnell to one side, most of those people seem to be on their way to the United States Senate and will be with us in January.
That's what's so remarkable about all this. First of all, when you first look at the Tea Party, or the formation of the Tea Party, this loose coalition of Tea Party supporters, you knew that they hated Barack Obama. You knew that they hated his so-called socialist agenda. And yet, as it turns out, they also hate the Republican establishment. Mike Castle learned that in Delaware. Lisa Murkowski learned that in Alaska. Jane Norton learned that in Colorado. Trey Grayson, which of course means very Grayson in French, Trey Grayson in Kentucky learned that lesson when he lost to Rand Paul in the primary, despite Mitch McConnell's big backing of Trey Grayson. So there is a feeling out there, there's an anger out there that's not just focused on the guy in the White House, it's also at the Republican establishment. And, you know, for all the talk about Democrats sitting home in November, you wonder what the moderates in the Republican Party feel between now and November 2nd or afterwards, when you may have a Republican Senate of far more conservative senators than you had in the 111th Congress.
Now, Jim DeMint has said he would prefer a Senate in which there were 30 Republicans he truly trusted, 30 Republicans he knew were conservatives on every issue, than a Senate in which you had 40 or 45 or even a majority of Republicans who were all over the map ideologically, or at least all over the historical Republican definition of the ideological map. He doesn't want that. He doesn't want a multifaceted, two-winged party. He wants a hard right party that he can rely on, and he has made that very clear, and the kind of candidates he's been going around the country and supporting are people who agree with him on that.
Well, Mitch McConnell is not going to face a challenge, most probably not.
Why bother to challenge him? Why not let him stay in the very difficult job of being the Republican leader and be instead, if you're Jim DeMint, the leader of a hard group of 10, 15, maybe 20, maybe 25, who must be dealt with by Mitch McConnell on every issue. In another, be a kind of shadow leader.
That's a very good point, and I think that's one of the main differences between 2010 and 1994, because as much as there was tremendous anger among Republicans against Bill Clinton in 1994, most Republicans were on the same page. They were not battling between insurgents and establishment candidates. They were all together against those terrible Democrats. Now the Republicans seem to be battling each other as much as they are battling Obama and the Democrats.
Let's take a quick look at New York, a state I know is close to your heart. We had another Tea Party-style candidate there who came from relative obscurity and came from the western part of the state, came from Buffalo, and beat Rick Lazio for the gubernatorial nomination in the state of New York. His name is Carl Paladino. He's never run for office before. He's a businessman. He's in real estate. He's kind of an outspoken fella. He has a lot to say, and he has been associated with a number of pieces of humor that may come back to haunt him in the fall campaign. And yet, I can't imagine that the establishment New York City Republican types are very happy about Carl Paladino, but now he's their candidate. What do they do?
Well, first of all, I don't think it changes anything because nobody was going to beat Andrew Cuomo anyway. The establishment Republican was Rick Lazio, the former congressman, the guy who ran against Hillary Clinton in 2000 for the Senate. He just didn't excite anybody in the Republican primary at all. As a matter of fact, the state chairman, Ed Cox, who's Richard Nixon's son-in-law, was trying to recruit a Democrat, the Suffolk County executive, to run for governor against Cuomo. So the Republican Party was never on the same page. Carl Paladino forwarded those racist and sexist and offensive emails, and he just thought it's just the whole thing is funny. But he had, you know, $3 million of his own money. He was one of those mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore kind of candidates.
It's going to take more than $3 million this fall.
Oh, yeah. Well, Andrew Cuomo has like $25 million. But the thing is, look, nobody's going to beat Andrew Cuomo, but Paladino is going to certainly rough him up a little. The two fighters will get in the ring, but Paladino's going to definitely go, you know, hit after the bell, below the belt, all that kind of stuff, because Cuomo doesn't want to get engaged in this kind of stuff at all. He's not doing much overt campaigning. He thinks basically it's anointed to him. You know, I've been the governor in waiting. David Paterson was just, you know, a placeholder for the longest time. I always knew it would be mine, and that's the way I face it. Carl Paladino's not going to let him get away with that, even though it still will be a Democratic route.
All right. On the Senate side, both Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand nominated for their Senate seats. Neither one of them seems to have much of a competition in November. The most interesting House race, there were no surprises among the House race primaries, but the most interesting House race, I suppose, was Charlie Rangel's. And he prevailed in the end over four candidates. No one was surprised at that, but he did get over 51% of the vote, and the closest of the also-rans was Adam Clayton Powell IV at 23%, as I remember.
That's correct. And look, for all the ethics problems that Charlie Rangel has, and they're legitimate problems, there's 13 counts of alleged ethical violations. But at the same time, if the closest candidate was Adam Clayton Powell, IV, he had the name, and he had, you know, of course, his father was the guy that Rangel unseated in 1970, but Powell was a flawed candidate. I mean, aside from the name, he did not have a distinguished record in the New York State Assembly. He had personal problems. There were some allegations about relations with women and driving and things like that. So Rangel was never really in trouble in Harlem. 40 years in Congress will now be 41, assuming the ethics problems don't remove him from the House of Representatives.
And I don't think we're looking at that. We're looking at more like a reprimand, is my impression.
Right.
We'll see what happens in the course of that trial. All right, moving west just a little bit, there was a gubernatorial primary in Wisconsin where the county executive for Milwaukee County, largest county, of course, in the state, Scott Walker, easily beat back a challenge from a guy who was really a throwback to the last, if you will, Tea Party revolution, the 1994 Gingrich revolution, Mark Newman. He, in the end, only got about 40% of the vote and wasn't that big a threat to Scott Walker, who looks like he's on his way to being the new governor of Wisconsin.
Well, part of the problem for Mark Newman is that, you know, he narrowly lost a Senate race to Russ Feingold back in 1998. He has not even much been heard from since then, although when he was running for governor, he did spend a lot of his own money and was trying to make it competitive. But the fact is, Scott Walker was, again, the anointed candidate. This time, the establishment was victorious in Wisconsin. And when you have a Republican coming out of Milwaukee County, you know, it could very well nullify the usual Democratic votes you get out of Milwaukee. The Democratic nominee there is Milwaukee Mayor and former Congressman Tom Barrett. Jim Doyle, the incumbent Democratic governor, is retiring because basically the economy is in the toilet and his numbers are terrible. So I think Wisconsin is one of those states where the Republicans look to pick up. But, you know, the Democrats still could pick up a lot of Republican seats as well in the governor's races in places like Connecticut and Vermont and Rhode Island and things like that. Rhode Island is fascinating, though, because if anything, I think the Republican Party finishes third there. The question is whether the winner will be the Democratic nominee or the independent Lincoln Chafee, the former senator.
You know, all through this campaign year, all through these primaries, we've been talking about how it was an ideological division in the Republican Party that was resulting in these Tea Party candidates, or at least the more conservative option, winning out against the establishment candidate, and that had all kinds of implications about people's feelings about the Republican Party and the establishment and so on. But Wisconsin makes me wonder just a little bit, because in this instance, Scott Walker was the establishment candidate, but he was also the more attractive candidate. He was the more interesting candidate. In a lot of these other states, Rand Paul against Trey Grayson in Kentucky. Trey Grayson was very gray. He was not very exciting. Rand Paul was much more exciting. In Alaska, Joe Miller was much more exciting to people than Lisa Murkowski. In Utah, there was this insurgent thing going on, and Robert Bennett was kind of the good gray senator who had been there for a long time. Sue Loudon in Nevada, exactly.
Right.
There you go. Sue Loudon in Nevada was kind of a shot in the foot kind of candidate, whereas Sharon Angle, while she said a lot of crazy things too, she came on a lot stronger and was a little luckier in terms of her media experiences, and she just had more momentum in that comparison. And I think we saw that again in New York. Rick Lazio, whatever else you want to say about him, is kind of a uninspiring, ordinary kind of candidate. I think somebody described him as placid. This is not a good year for a placid Republican.
We really don't know what's going to happen in November, whether these candidates are so right-wing they hurt the Republican Party, or the Rand Pauls and the Sharon Angles will energize the base in such a way that they get out voters who never would have come out to vote, and they win, you know, the seats in November. And especially if Sharon Angle, and we say this over and over again, but the fact that Sharon Angle, who is just mocked mercilessly for her positions throughout the media, the fact that she's running dead even with Harry Reid says a lot about Democratic prospects for November and, of course, Harry Reid's viability as a Democratic leader in the Senate.
So as we lurch our way towards November 2nd, we have now completed virtually all of the primary activity. There is a little cleaning up, little mopping up action in Louisiana and Hawaii yet. But basically, we're done. We've had at least one round of voting in 50 states and the District of Columbia, where the mayor of 4 years running, Adrian Fenty, who won every ward and every voting precinct when he was elected 4 years ago, was dismissed, largely because he lost the African-American base vote in the city. He's been kicked out. There is a restive feeling in the country. We really don't know how far it's going to go, but we do assume that as the alternative party, the out party, the Republican Party is going to be the primary beneficiary of all this, and we don't know yet if the energy is going to be so strong that it would carry even, let us say, a Christine O'Donnell to competitiveness in Delaware. Who is the leader of this Republican Party that's about to be ascendant, Ken?
Ryan, I think you really hit it on the head a few moments ago when you said that if you're a conservative Republican, if you're Jim DeMint, clearly a power broker in the Republican Party, let Mitch McConnell stay as Republican leader. Let him battle with Harry Reid or Dick Durbin or whoever the Democrats have as their leader in the minority or the majority come January 2011. But let Jim DeMint be the ideologically pure kind of guy who says, we are the message party and my candidates are the message candidates.
So that's a formula for Jim DeMint in the Senate. Over on the House side, where they have a much stronger prospect of taking the majority in November than they have in the Senate, John Boehner is currently the leader of the Republican Party. His number two, Eric Cantor, has said he won't challenge John Boehner if they take the majority for the Speaker's gavel. So it appears it's going to be John Boehner. Does he become the spokesperson of the Republican Party, as Newt Gingrich indeed was in 1993 and 1994 under the presidency of Bill Clinton? I put it to you, Ken Rudin.
the fact that John Boehner is still in a position to be Speaker of the House is such a remarkable phenomenon. I mean, if you think of everything that's happened to him, he was part of the Gingrich Revolution in 94, but then he broke with Newt, who was one of the people who plotted against him, lost his leadership post, came back during the fall of Tom DeLay, and then he was the Republican leader in the House when they lost 31 seats in 2006, when they lost another 20 seats in 2008.
And I was stunned. I'm stunned that they didn't get rid of him after those two losses.
Exactly, and he's still the leader, and he could very well be the next Speaker of the House. Now, if the Republicans don't get the 39 seats, they need to take over the majority. If they can't do it in 2010, then Boehner has got to go. But I guess, obviously, if they get the numbers, and a lot of people think that they will have the numbers to go over the top, Boehner is Speaker of the House, and that's just so remarkable. I mean, if you think of all the people who have become Speakers of the House, if you think of the Jim Wrights and the Tom Foleys, the Dennis Hastert's and the Newt Gingrich's, I've never seen any of them go from pariah to Speaker in such a fascinating way as John Boehner may be doing.
And yet I don't see him as necessarily right now or 6 months from now the leader of this newly ascendant Republican Party. Just last weekend, he said he could accept a deal whereby tax cuts were passed for 97% of the population, but not for the last 3%, if he couldn't get what he wanted, which was 100%.
Right.
Now, this is, of course, not a new tax cut, but just the extension of the tax cuts that are otherwise expiring.
So, right, the Bush tax cuts.
That's right. And there's been a lot of talk about leaving the tax rate where it is for virtually everyone, but not for people making over $250,000 a year per household, so as to save the revenue from the tax on the rich, essentially the top two tax rates, which is $700 billion over a 10-year period. That's a fairly large chunk of change, even in the federal budget. So this is a big issue right now. John Boehner signaled he might be willing to accept a tax cut for all but the top 2 or 3%. And over the next several days, Mitch McConnell...
Hours.
Mitch McConnell and a lot of other Republicans were coming out saying...
Hold on.
Oh, no, I won't. Maybe John Boehner's willing to do business, but I'm not willing to take that deal. And he actually had to back down. So it's very hard to see him in a Gingrichian kind of power position or to see him as the new spokesman of the ascendant Republican Party when he can't even speak his own mind on taxes without being slapped down and spanked and dismissed.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he said the wrong thing. I thought when he said that, he said, I'd be willing to accept, you know, as long I wouldn't want to sacrifice tax cuts for the 97%, even if the richest 3% don't get the tax cuts. I thought what he did basically was to show that we Republicans can compromise, whereas Obama and the Democrats cannot. And I thought for a second he was taking an issue away from the Democratic Party.
I thought he was making a smart and strategic kind of move. And here's another smart and strategic move. That's it for this week's Political Podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
T for two and two for tea. Can't you see how happy we could be? There's nobody near us.